Hi, good morning, everyone. I'm so pleased that you've joined us today. If you're at Grace Church in Girard or Harbor Creek or the McCain Commons Service, or if you're watching online, my name is Derek. I'm one of the pastors here at Grace, and I don't take for granted that you've joined us today in this first Sunday in Lent. I mean, of all the things that you could have done this morning, you chose to honor God by gathering with His church, and you chose to prioritize your soul, and for that, I think you're to be commended. We've developed a lovely and I hope helpful resource for this series. It's a daily devotional guide that you should have gotten today, and I would urge you to use it every day to find your chair and to meet with God. This tool is going to make it very, very easy to do, and I would also encourage you to make it a priority to come to church through this whole series, to walk through this whole book of the Bible together with us. Commit yourself to gathering with the church every Sunday through Easter. I think it would please God, and I think it will benefit your life as well. So we're going to study together this New Testament book of Hebrews. And you can tell that the author of Hebrews is concerned about his original audience. And if I were to summarize his concern, here's what it is, I think. That original church was a bit immature. I think some of them thought that faith in Jesus would be easy. These are folks who had grown up in Jewish homes, and at some point they made the leap over to Christianity. And they thought, you know, this is going to be great. Jesus was a great teacher. He was a healer. He did miraculous things. Surely I'm going to start living my best life. And some of you have had a similar journey. Maybe you came out of a strict traditional background, and you came to a church like Grace, and you thought, you know, this is great. Or maybe you were freed from a habit or an addiction or a difficult situation, and you received Jesus, recognizing that He could set you free from those things. And He has. But the original crowd, you know, some of them started facing severe persecution. Family members weren't too crazy about this newfangled religion they were a part of. Their culture was in direct opposition to their new way of faith, their new sexual ethic, their new allegiance to Jesus instead of any allegiance to country. And because of this pressure, some of them saw their friends walking away from their faith and returning to their old way of life. And I think they hit this moment where they said, wait, this was supposed to be easier. I mean, I'm supposed to wake up every morning and shine up my halo and strum Hillsong tunes on my magic harp that sits next to my bed. And it's all supposed to be rainbows and butterflies. And when it didn't go quite like that, a lot of them were ready to give up on Jesus, to go back to their old way. Many of them to return to their Jewish faith. It wasn't nearly as demanding or controversial as this Christian faith. And some of you can truly relate to that scenario. And the author of Hebrews has a message for them. Don't give up. Jesus is greater. Go all the way with Him. Press in and don't fall away. And again, some of you, if you're honest, you're struggling with your faith, even today. You thought that you would accept Jesus and everything would become peace and love. Mr. Right was supposed to come swooping in, the perfect blend of tough and tender, and then you'd get married. But it hasn't happened. Or maybe you feel like the temptations are getting more tempting since you became a Christian and not less. Or you're in pain or shame, and it's hard to feel spiritual when you're in pain or shame all the time. And so your faith is lagging, and I believe the writer of Hebrews has the same message for you. Don't give up. Christ is better. Go all the way with Him. Press in and don't fall away. And so we're going to launch into a study of this New Testament letter of Hebrews. In fact, you can find your way there in your Bible or device. It's toward the end of the Bible, about 9 books in or so from the back cover. And I'm super excited to walk through this with you. But listen, Hebrews is a tough book. William Barclay calls it the most difficult book in the entire New Testament, but I believe it's also one of the most rewarding books in the whole Bible if we will lead into it. But it's tough. And it's tough for a couple reasons. One is that we don't really know who wrote it. The traditional kind of leading contenders of authorship are like Barnabas or Apollos or maybe even Luke or Priscilla is probably not Paul. But I'll go with the scholar Origen who said it this way. He said, I don't know who wrote it. All I know is that God is behind it. But the other reason that it's hard is because it's the most doctrine-heavy book of the New Testament, maybe next to Romans. And so there are some deep concepts being presented in Hebrews. Some go all the way back to the Old Testament, to Leviticus. Some of you remember Leviticus. It's the third book in the Bible. And it was that place maybe that you decided to stop reading the Bible cover to cover. You're like, oh, Genesis is pretty interesting. Exodus is pretty good. Leviticus? What the? I'm done, right? And so But this book of Hebrews is also tough because there are warning passages. There are at least six warning passages in the book, and all of them are pretty direct and difficult, and we're going to deal with the first of them today. But even though it's tough for these reasons, I'm so pumped that we're going to go through it together. And there are three main reasons that I'm excited about this. And I also put these on the very first page of your study guide so you can be reminded as we go. So why are we studying Hebrews? Here's a few reasons. The first is because Jesus is greater than everything. This is the focus of this book. He is greater than anything that has come before him or will come after him. And what a perfect focus for Lent. And so I just want to give you a quick glimpse of how the book is organized. This is also in your study guide. But I want you to see it in one place. You can see as the chapters roll along that Jesus is greater than the prophets. He's greater than the angels, greater than Moses, greater than Joshua, greater than the Old Testament priesthood, greater than the Old Covenant ministry. Are you getting the point? Jesus is greater. He's greater than your hardships. He's greater than your old life. He's greater than the elections. He's greater than the coronavirus. He's greater. And so this is the perfect thing for us to be reminded of right now. But here's the second reason to study Hebrews. It's that it shows us that the Bible is one grand story. Hebrews contains 35 direct quotes from the Old Testament. And so there are these major tie-ins to the rest of the Bible. So we can see from cover to cover that Christ is the fulfillment of all of the Old Testament hopes and promises. But the third reason is because Hebrews urges us not to fall away from the faith. There's actually an epidemic of Christians and even young Christian leaders who are deconverting from the Christian faith. And so this call to not fall away is so pertinent to us today. And so this is going to be a great journey for us together. And I'd like to go right to the beginning. So let's open up to Hebrews chapter 1, starting in verse 1. And I think we're going to see this big idea that Jesus is enough all by himself. Jesus is enough all by himself. So here we go. Hebrews 1, 1. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. So let's stop right there. For my points today, I'm simply going to complete this sentence. Jesus is enough, and here's point one. Jesus is enough because he's God's ultimate message to you. And so it says right here that long ago, God spoke. And so I just want to stop and dwell on that for a minute. It says here that God spoke. And we need to draw a clear line in the sand right there. God is not some idea to be pondered. He's not some impersonal force out there. He's not some ethereal concept to be meditated on. God is communicating. God speaks. He's a person to be known and loved and listened to and obeyed. He's not some abstract reality to be meditated on. He's actively speaking and he's wooing us. And he's saying, hey, listen. Hey, let's go this way. Hey, let's watch that. Let's go here. God is speaking to us. And then he says, in many times and in many ways. And so God's creativity is endless in how he speaks. It started with creation, where God spoke with cosmic eloquence. It's pretty magnificent in his creation. And then he spoke with prophetic eloquence, with incredible diversity. He spoke in audible voices. He whispered out of whirlwinds. He wrote on walls. He appeared in burning bushes. He inspired worship songs. He put messages in the mouths of donkeys. He even inspired a book of erotic poetry. Hello. He spoke to Moses with thunder and lightning, to Elijah with a still small voice, to Ezekiel in visions, to Daniel in dreams, to Abraham as a human, to Jacob as an angel. He declared himself by law and warning and exhortation and prototype and parable. He even used bizarre symbolic acts. But in these last days, the author says, in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son. So will you underline that and just write God's ultimate message? Jesus is the ultimate speech of God. Jesus is God's final word. And Jesus is enough because he's God's ultimate message to you. And what God is doing here is he's communicating or revealing himself. He doesn't want to be hidden or mysterious or distant. And so this revealing of yourself is a very relational thing to do. He wants a relationship. Have you ever been early on in a relationship, even just a friendship? And up until this point, everything has been kind of surfacey. Like you hung out together, you went to the gym together, you watched a game together, you ate together, shopped together, whatever. But then one day you find yourself in a kind of vulnerable moment. When you're like, hey, tell me more about you. What was growing up like for you? And then the person begins to reveal something, maybe some hurts or wounds or just some deep stuff that has shaped who they are today. And all of a sudden, there's a depth to the friendship that wasn't there before. You know what I'm talking about? To reveal yourself to someone is a very relational and very risky thing to do. And especially to this Jewish audience, God was historically kind of unapproachable. In fact, there was this famous Old Testament warning where God said, "No man shall see my face and live," right? Not exactly a great icebreaker. Try that at your next life group. You're going around the circle. Hey, I'm John. I'm an architect. I'm Mary. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm Jehovah. No man shall see my face and live. Whoa, okay, dude. All right. So for many generations, they weren't allowed to even speak or write the name of God. And now God is offering himself in special relationship. It says he spoke by revealing his son. God took a chance on you. He's revealed himself to you, and now he took the position of vulnerability, and he said, okay, here's who I am. Here's me. Take it or leave it. So Jesus is God's ultimate message to you. Now look again at verse 2. He goes on to describe what Jesus reveals. He says, he has spoken to us by his son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, and through whom also he created the world. He's the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. And after making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. Now, here's the second point. Let's complete the sentence again. Jesus is enough because he has complete authority over your life. So what happens here is that we get this kind of litany of descriptors about the uniqueness of Jesus. It's kind of like his resume. And these first four verses of Hebrews, they kind of provide the summary for the whole rest of the book, which is why we're spending some time here today. But you can see that simply making the case that Jesus is greater, he's superior to everything. And this theme is going to continue through the whole book. But I want you to just take a moment and look at these descriptors of Jesus. You can underline these as we go. Verse 2 says that he's the heir of all things. Heir just means the one that it's all coming to, right? So think of a father giving the estate, you know, his estate to his son. Everything that God created, everything that God did on earth, it was for Jesus. The prophets were pointing to something. The covenants were pointing to something. The sacrifices were pointing to something. Jesus is the thing they were pointing to. He's the point. All right, look at verses 2 and 3. It says, and you can underline, he created the world. And then in 3, he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Nobody else did this. I want you to get this picture in your mind. Imagine that the distance between the earth and the sun, 93 million miles, was the thickness of a sheet of paper, all right? Just the thickness of a sheet of paper, 93 million miles. Do you know that the distance then between the earth and the nearest star beyond the sun would be a stack of papers like this 70 feet high? The distance across the galaxy would be a stack of papers like this 310 miles high. Right? Our galaxy is just one little speck of dust in the universe as it is. And our universe is of modest size compared to millions of other universes. Jesus is so powerful. It says here, he created that. And he upholds all of that by the word of his power. And here's what we're supposed to see. If there is a person that powerful, is he the type of person that you would ask into your life to be your assistant? No. He has complete authority. Like if he can handle the universe, he can handle helping you through your issues with your deadbeat husband or your insensitive boss or whatever it is. He has complete authority. Now, verse 3 also says that he is the radiance of the glory of God. Just like you can't look directly at the sun, Jesus is the brightness of God's glory. He's the Shekinah glory. You can hardly even take him in. And then it says that he's the exact imprint of God's nature. The exact imprint of God's nature. Think about what that means. I want to give you a little illustration. Long ago, if people saw something beautiful or amazing, and then they wanted to relay that to their friends, all they could do was explain it. They only had words. Have you ever seen or experienced something and you wished that your best friend or your spouse could have been there with you, and you try to explain that thing and what was going on, knowing that your words would never do it justice? Ever had that? That they had to be there? Well, that's all people had at one time. But as time went on, people were able to take a beautiful scene and maybe give it a sense of what it was like by a painting or a drawing. But if you're an art history buff, you'll know that paintings existed for a long time, just kind of flat, before anyone realized how to capture perspective. And then one day in Florence, people began to paint with perspective. They figured out the mathematics, and they would put it on the canvas and make it look realistic. And then we had photographs, starting with black and white photographs, these stiff figures. And then we got color. And then we got moving pictures, movies that could capture panorama. All of a sudden, stuff was a little bit more realistic. And then we got high definition, which, by the way, is already antiquated. I still have an old-fashioned HD TV, but I'm in the dark ages because then there was 2K, and then there was 4K. Now there's 8K QLED screens. The Q stands for quantum dots, and these are 16 times the resolution of dumb old HD. All right? What the author of Hebrews is saying here is that Jesus is more than all of that. He's more than a picture. He's more than an image. He's not 8K. He's better than 8,000K. He's the exact imprint of God. And what he means is this, and unless you get this, you're not going to get any of Hebrews. He means that in Jesus, you see God exactly. You see God. Everything that God is, Jesus is. Everything that Jesus is, God is. And if you want to see what God is like, you look at Jesus. And if you want to see how God would respond in a certain way, situation, watch how Jesus responds. You see, we don't have to wonder. We don't have to make stuff up in our heads. He came down in the flesh as God himself. And we have records of all his movements right here in the scriptures, which is why he can confidently go on and say that he's greater than the angels and the prophets and the high priests and Moses and the old covenant. Why? Because he's God. And then we get this last descriptor at the end of verse 3. He said, after making purification for our sins, that he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. I love that. So he saved us, and then he sat down. And in those days, they understood that you sit down when there's nothing left to do, when it's completed. And then sitting down at the right hand of the supreme king was like an image of ultimate honor and authority. So again here, the exclamation point is this. He has complete authority over your life. And because of that, he's worthy of all your worship. So that's the first few verses. And then verse 4 through the rest of chapter 1 and really much of chapter 2 makes this specific case that Jesus is better than the angels. And the original audience, that they would have heard all these Old Testament verses that you'll read in these first two chapters, one after the other after the other, and they would have gone, wow, wow, wow. And you're probably going to read them this week and go, huh? And the reason is that angels were big in Judaism. There are over 100 mentions in the Old Testament, over 160 mentions in the New Testament. And this word angel, it simply means messenger. These were awesome creatures. I want to just give you a few references so you can feel the weight of this teaching. When the prophet Isaiah saw the seraphim, the angel, which is translated the burning ones, hovering over the altar, they were equipped insect-like with three pairs of wings, two fiery wings covering their faces, two wrapped over their feet, and two glowing wings beating the air as they chanted, "Holy, holy, holy." And Isaiah was severely traumatized, understandably. If you would have seen that, you would have done two things. You'd have peed your pants, you'd have probably worshiped that thing. And he's like, that's nothing compared to Jesus. Sometimes angels had more human-like appearance. They were mistaken for people. Other times they would shine with glorious light. Either way, angels wielded immense power. They could strike down entire armies. They were delivering captives. They were waging heavenly battles. Why were angels such a big deal to these original readers? Well, because a lot of the members of this original church, they were still feeling a ton of cultural pressure to go back to Judaism. And it seems that one of the ways out of this new Christianity would be to declare that Jesus was just an angel, but he wasn't God. And if they would just say that, then they would be accepted back into the synagogue and all would be good. And so they were tempted to compromise their beliefs. But the author lays out here the superiority of Jesus in every way, that despite their cosmic powers, Jesus is greater than any angel. In fact, the angels fall down and worship him whenever he walks in the room. So I'm ready to move on to point 3 here, but before I do, we need to dwell here for just a moment longer, because comparing angels to Jesus probably isn't a big temptation for most of us. So we're like, okay. But there's an underlying principle here. So I think the modern equivalent is this. Where are you being tempted to compromise the identity of Jesus? You see, They were being tempted to just hang on to the parts of Jesus that were convenient for them, the stuff that wouldn't rock the boat with their friends and families and political opposites in the workplace. So they're like, oh, Jesus is fine, but if I just say that he was an angel, it protects me against ridicule and opposition, and it opens other doors for me to advance. What is that for you? Are you compromising the identity of Jesus by saying, oh, I think Jesus was just a great teacher, but I'm not buying in all the way? Or I think Jesus was a good moral leader, but I won't go so far as to say that he was God or that he's the only way to heaven. Yeah, that's not popular. That's not culturally acceptable. That's not going to go over well with my friends. And so I'm not willing to go that far. That's what we'd have to wrestle with. And our author here is saying, Jesus has a unique position and authority in your life. And anything less than full surrender and submission to his will is not enough. He deserves your full allegiance. He is God's ultimate message to you, and he has complete authority over your life. Here's the third. Jesus is enough, so don't neglect his great salvation. Flip over to the first four verses of chapter 2. The first four verses of chapter 2, I want to read them to you. It says, therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? It was declared at first by the Lord, and it was attested to us by those who heard, while God also bore witness by signs and wonders and various miracles and by gifts of the Spirit distributed according to his will. And so let me summarize in modern terms. God didn't come to you threatening judgment. He came overflowing with love and absorbed your judgment in your place. And if you won't listen to that, like if you ignore that, or you turn away from that, or you drift away from that, what hope is there for you? This is a warning. Underline that phrase in verse 1, lest we drift away, and just write, don't neglect salvation. So how do we protect ourselves from drifting away, turning our backs on this salvation? Well, he says there in verse 1, he says we must pay closer attention to what we have heard. And the word attention here literally means obsession. It's a very strong word. Much closer attention could be translated furiously obsessed. And that sounds like a little much. But he's telling us, anyone who hears the gospel and says, okay, I agree, now I'm a Christian, I believe that you've only just started to become what God can make you. Now, become furiously obsessed with the gospel, the good news that Jesus gave his life for you. You don't just move on and say, well, I got that part down. You know, the thing about Jesus dying for my sins, that's fine, now I'm ready to move on. No, you're going to drift. Unless you take that message and obsess over it, obsess over his grace, obsess over his mercy, obsess over God's outrageous love, you have to work it into your life like kneading it into bread. Work it deep into your soul and your attitudes, into your behaviors. This salvation of you is outrageous. I mean, there was an article in Christianity Today some years ago by Philip Yancey titled, "The Atrocious Mathematics of the Gospel." And it speaks to the fact that God's idea of fairness isn't usually the same as ours. You see, from nursery school onward, we're taught about fairness, how to succeed in this world. The early bird gets the worm, no pain, no gain. Demand your rights, nothing is free. We know these rules well because we live by them. I work for what I earn, I like to win, I insist on my rights. I want people to get what they deserve. Nothing more, nothing less, right? We want the world to be fair. And we want God to be fair. But God isn't fair, and honestly, that's a good thing. Because fairness means that you deserve judgment, and instead God gave you mercy. You deserved wrath, and you got grace. You deserved chains, and you got freedom. This is the gospel, and this truth needs to work its way deep into us, lest we neglect such a great salvation. I think of the Old Testament story of Hosea. He was a prophet who God asked to marry a prostitute. Remember this guy? God allowed him to go through the pain of watching his wife whore herself around town to other men so Hosea could feel what God feels when he loves people who don't love him back. And Hosea is ready to give up and throw in the towel after his wife's latest tryst when God tells him in Hosea 3:1, he says, go show your love to your wife again. Though she's loved by another and is an adulteress, love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods. Guys, Hosea's wife didn't get fairness. She didn't even get justice. She got grace. And every time I read their story or I read through Hosea and get God's speeches in this book that begin with sternness and they dissolve into tears, I marvel at a God who allows himself to endure such humiliation only to come back for more. And he says things like, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel, and just substitute your own name in there for Ephraim and Israel? How can I give up on you, Allison? How can I hand you over, John? You see, at the heart of the gospel is a God who deliberately surrenders himself to the wild, irresistible power of love. God isn't fair, and thank God he's not. That's the gospel. Pay closer attention to it. Obsess over it. Work it into your soul. And this passage in Hebrews chapter 2 is the first warning passage of the book. And some of you need to hear and heed this warning. You see, there's a group of people here listening to the sound of my voice, and you believe that Jesus was God. You believe it in your head. You're just not paying that much attention to him. You don't hate Jesus. You're just thinking, you know, not now. This is not a great time. I've got a lot of other things going on my plate right now. The author's point is this. What else could God do? He took on flesh. He went to the cross in your place. And I can understand if you don't believe that. But if you do believe it and just ignore it, just live as if it didn't happen, he's saying don't neglect, don't drift away from so great a salvation. And so we learned Jesus is enough because he's God's ultimate message to you, because he has complete authority over your life, and so don't neglect his great salvation. Now, before I close this out, I want to give you a couple next steps. I said them at the beginning. I'm going to repeat them here. Will you commit to gather with the church every week through Lent? Take an hour or so each week to invest in your spiritual life, into your soul. It's the most important part of you. But here's the thing, we've also provided you with a free and a fantastic daily resource. There are readings for 5 days a week in there. And so would you also find your chair and use the study guide every day through Lent? I believe that more than any other habit, that the practice of meeting with God every day in his word will change the course of your life. And Lent provides us with this confessional season. And so as we think specifically of Hebrews and this theme of the supremacy of Jesus, we have a chance to ponder. Let me ask it this way. What is competing for the throne of your life? Like, what else is on the throne? Has your job snuck on there? How about your family, material wealth? Could this Lenten season for you be a dethroning process? Like, as we look at this book of Hebrews that reminds us that Jesus is greater, that he's enough all by himself, can you take some other stuff off that throne that you've put on there? Now, I want to close today and prepare us for worship by just drawing our attention and focusing our obsession on Jesus. He is greater. As N.T. Wright said, that the hurricane has become human. The fire has become flesh. The author of life has walked among us. And Christianity is either the deepest disclosure of reality or it's a sham. It's totally bogus. But it's one of those two things. And yet most people settle for living in the shallow world in between. They believe that it's true, but they don't do much about it. I'm here to tell you guys, if your definition of Jesus doesn't change everything about you, then you have the wrong definition. These first two chapters of Hebrews are all about making much of Jesus, the supremacy of Jesus, the glory of Jesus, the majesty of Jesus. And the author seems to think that should be enough for us. And so what are our options? We either align ourselves with that truth and we repent and we realize that Jesus alone is enough, or we live in a delusional world of self and worship is all about me and church is all about me and the gospel is all about me. That's a world that I fear many people are living in. And so here's my hope. I want to turn our hearts to worship him because of who he is. I want him to be enough. I want him and him alone to be enough for us. I want Jesus all by himself. That he would engage our souls to impress us so that when we read through this book of Hebrews that we'll absolutely fall down at the feet of the great and glorious Jesus. That his name would be supreme in our lives. And that we would become less and that he would become more. That we would no longer make the gospel and the scriptures and make God about us, but that we would make it all about him, because that's exactly what scripture does. It's all about him. It's not about us, and we have to align ourselves with that reality and that truth, or else our Christianity and our gospel will become shallow and uninspiring. There is too much at stake. And so my prayer is that we would worship him because he has the greatest name, and that we would worship him because he has the greatest authority, and that we would worship him because he has the greatest position. Jesus is enough all by himself. And so will you spend a moment now reflecting on that truth? Let him speak to you, and then our worship team is going to come and lead us. But if God gives you something to share in this time with somebody else in the room, a word of encouragement or knowledge or prayer, would you please respond? Go to them and do what God told you to do. And then we're going to blow the roof off this place in worship because he is enough.